Chapter 30. Cardenio Rebound. Page Runner. Any character who is out of his or her book and moves through the backstory, or more rarely the plot, of another book. Page runners may be lost, vacationing, part of the character exchange program, or criminals, intent on mischief. See, Bowdlerizers. Texters. Slang term given to a relatively harmless page runner, QV, usually juvenile, who surfs from book to book for adventure and rarely appears in the front story but does, on occasion, cause small changes to text and or plot lines. Unitary Authority of Warrington Cat, the Jurisfiction Guide to Book Jumping. Glossary. Harris Tweed and the Cheshire Cat took me back to the library. We sat on a bench in front of the Boojumorial and Harris stared at me while the cat, who was nothing if not courteous, went to get me a pasty from the snack bar just next to Mr. Wemmick's storeroom.
"Where did she find you?" snapped Harris.
I was getting used to his aggressive mannerisms by now. If he thought as little of me as he made out, then I wouldn't be here at all. The cat popped his head up between us and said,
"Hot or cold pasty?"
"Hot, please."
"Okay, then,"
he said, and vanished again. I explained Havisham's leap from the Goliath vault to the washing label. Tweed was clearly impressed. He had been apprenticed to Commander Bradshaw many years previously, and Bradshaw's accuracy in book jumping was as poor as Havisham's was good, hence the Commander's interest in maps.
"A washing label? Now that is impressive," muses Harris. "Not many pros would even attempt to jump blind into less than 100 words. Havisham took quite a risk with you, Miss Next. Cat, what do you think?"
"I think," said the cat,
handing me a steaming hot pasty,
"that you've forgotten the Mogalicious cat food you promised,
"Sorry," I replied. "Next time."
"Okay,"
said the cat.
"Right," said Harris. "To business. Tell me, who were the chief players in Cardenio's discovery?"
"Well," I began, "there's Lord Volskamper, an hereditary peer. He said he found it in his library. Amiable chap, bit of a duffer. Then there's Yorick Kane, a Whig politician who hopes to use the free distribution of the play to sway the Shakespeare vote in his favour at tomorrow's election."
"I'll see if I can find which book they're from, if at all,"
said the cat, and vanished. "Is that really likely?" I asked. "Volskamper has been around since before the war, and Kane has been on the political scene for at least 5 years.
"It means nothing, Miss Next," replied Harris impatiently. "Mellor's had a wife and family in Slough for 2 decades, and Heathcliff worked in Hollywood for 3 years under the name of Buckstallion. No one suspected a thing in either case."
"But Cardenio?" I asked. "It is the library's copy, yes?"
"Without a doubt. Despite elaborate security arrangements, someone managed to swipe it from under the cat's whiskers. He's very upset about it."
"Did you say fig or wig?"
inquired the cat, who had reappeared.
"I said wig," I replied.
"And I wish you wouldn't keep appearing and vanishing so suddenly. You make one quite giddy."
"All right,"
said the cat. And this time he vanished quite slowly, beginning with the end of his tail and ending with his grin.
"He doesn't seem terribly upset," I observed. "Looks can be deceptive. In the cat's case, trebly so. We heard about Cardenio only yesterday. It nearly gave the bellman a fit. He was all for putting together one of his madcap and typically boojum-ridden expeditions. As soon as I found out that Kane was going to make Cardenio public property, I knew we had to act, and act fast."
"But listen," I said, my head spinning slightly with all this new intelligence. "Why is it so important that Cardenio remain lost? It's a brilliant play."
"I wouldn't expect you to understand," replied Tweed crossly. "But believe me, there are extremely good reasons why Cardenio must stay lost. Listen, it's no accident that only 7 out of Aeschylus 100 or so plays survive, or that Paradise Lost Once More will never be known."
"Why?"
"Don't ask," replied Tweed shortly. "And besides, if the rest of the book world figures out there is something to gain by swiping library books, then we could be in one hell of a state."
"Okay," I returned, quite used to secretive policing divisions at Spec Ops. "So why am I here?"
Clearly this is no place for an apprentice, but you know the layout of Vole Towers as well as having met the key suspects. Do you know where Cardenio is kept? In a combination and key safe within the library itself. Good. But first we need to get in. Can you remember any of the other books in the library? I thought for a moment. There was a rare first edition of Decline and Fall by Evelyn Waugh. Come on then, he said abruptly. No time for dawdling. We're off. We took the elevator to floor W of the library, found the copy we were looking for, and were soon within the book, tiptoeing past a noisy part in the quad at Scone College. Tweed concentrated on the outward jump, and a few moments later we were standing inside the locked library at Vole Towers. Cat, said Harris, looking around at the untidy library. You there?
Loud and clear, whiskers pressed, fed and watered, boots on and laced, ready to...
A simple yes will do. Send the safecrackers in by way of a first of Decline and Fall. If they come across Captain Grimes, they are not to lend him money on any account. Anything called Volscamper or Kane?
Not yet. None of the names appear in the register of fictioneers. I'm just going through the reams of unpublished characters from the Well of Lost Plots. It might take some time.
Blast! Exclaimed Tweed. Too much to hope they'd be stupid enough to use their own names. Two men suddenly appeared next to us, and Harris pointed them in the direction of the safe. One wore a fine evening dress, the other was attired in a more sober woolen suit and carried a holdall that once opened revealed an array of beautifully crafted safe-cracking tools. After running an expert eye over the safe for a few moments, the elder of the two removed his jacket, took the stethoscope proffered to him by his companion, and listened to the safe as he gently turned the combination wheel. "Is that Raffles?" I whispered. "The gentleman thief?" Harris nodded, checking his watch. "With his assistant, Bunny. If anyone can, they can." "So who do you think stole Cardenio?" "A good one for tricky questions, aren't you, next? We have a suspect list as long as your arm. There are several million possible contenders in the book world, and any one of them could have gone rogue, jumped out of their book, swiped Cardenio and legged it over here." "So how do you tell whether someone is an impostor or not?" Harris looked at me. "With great difficulty. Do you think I belong here in your world?" I looked at the short man with the elegant tweed herringbone suit and touched him gently on the chest with a finger. He was as real to me as anyone I had ever met, either within books or without. He breathed, smiled, scowled. How was I meant to tell? "I don't know. Are you from a 1920s detective novel?"
"Wrong," replied Harris. "I'm as real as you are. I work 3 days a week for Skyrail as a signals operator. But how could I prove that? I could just as easily be a minor character in an obscure novel somewhere. The only sure way to tell would be to place me under observation for 2 months. That's about the limit any book person can stay outside their book. But enough of this. Our first priority is to get the manuscript back. After that, we can start figuring out who is who."
"There's no quicker way?"
"Only one other that I know of. No book person is going to take a bullet. If you try and shoot one, chances are they'll jump."
"It sounds a bit like testing for witches. If they sink and drown, they're innocent."
"It's not ideal," said Harris gruffly. "I'm the first to admit that."
Within half an hour, Raffles had worked out the combination and now turned his attention to the secondary locking mechanism. He was slowly drilling a hole above the combination knob, and the quiet squeaking of the drill bit seemed inordinately loud to our heightened nerves. We were staring at him and silently urging him to go faster when a noise from the library's heavy door made us turn. Harris and I leaped to either side as the unlocking wheel spun to draw the steel tabs from the slots in the iron frame, and the door swung slowly open. Raffles and Bunny, well used to being disturbed, silently gathered up their tools and hid beneath a table.
"The manuscript will be released to the publishers first thing tomorrow morning," said Kane, as he and Volscamper strolled in.
Tweed pointed his automatic at them, and they jumped visibly. I pushed the door shut behind them and spun the locking mechanism.
"What is the meaning of this?"
said Volscamper in an outraged voice.
"Miss Next, is that you?"
"As large as life, Volscamper,"
I'm sorry, I have to search you. The two of them meekly acquiesced to a searching. They were unarmed, but Yorick Kane had turned a deep shade of crimson during the process.
Thieves, he spat. How dare you?
No, replied Harris, beckoning them further into the room and signalling for Raffles to continue with his work. We have only come to retrieve Cardenio, something that does not belong to either of you.
Now look here, I don't know what you're talking about, began Voskamper,
who was visibly outraged.
This house is surrounded by SO14 agents. There is no escape. And as for you, Miss Next, look here, I'm deeply disappointed by your perfidy.
What do you reckon? I said to Harris. His indignation seems real. It does, but he has less to gain from this than Kane. You're right. My money's on Kane.
What are you talking about? Demanded Kane angrily. The manuscript belongs to literature. How do you think you can sell something like this on the open market?
You may think you can get away with it, but I will die before I allow you to remove the literary heritage that belongs to all of us.
Well, I don't know, I added. Kane is pretty convincing, too.
Remember, he's a politician.
Of course, I returned, snapping my fingers. I'd forgotten.
What if it's neither? I didn't have time to answer as there was a crash from somewhere near the front of the house and the sound of an explosion. A low guttural moan reached our ears, followed by the terrified scream of a man in mortal terror. A shiver ran up my spine and I could see that everyone else in the room had felt it too. Even the implacable Raffles paused for a moment before returning to work with just a little bit more urgency.
Cat! Exclaimed Harris. What's going on?
I hope I'm mistaken, but you've got the questing beast approaching from the southeast, 100 yards and closing.
The questing beast? Exclaimed Tweed.
The Glatticent? Summon King Pellinor immediately.
He's in Middlemarch at the moment. I'll try him on the footnotophone, but you know how deaf he is.
The questing beast? I asked. Is that bad?
Bad, replied Harris. It's the worst. Think loathsome, think repulsive, think evil, think of escape.
The questing beast was born in the oral tradition before books, an amalgam of every dark and fetid horror that ever sprang from the most depraved recesses of the human imagination, all rolled into one foul-smelling package. It has many names, but its goal is always the same, death and destruction. As soon as it comes through the door, anyone still in here will be stone-cold dead.
Through the vault door?
There is no barrier yet created that can withstand the questing beast. Except a Pellinor. They have hunted it for years.
Harris turned to Kane and Voskamper.
But there's one thing it does tell us. One of you is fictional. One of you has invoked the questing beast. I want to know who it is.
Kane and Voskamper looked at Tweed, then at me, at each other, and finally at the steel door as we heard another low moan. The light machine gun at the front door fell silent and a splintering of wood met our ears as the questing beast forced its way through the main entrance and moved its odious form closer to the library.
Cat! Yelled Tweed again. Where's that King Pellinor I asked for?
He's not answering. Do you know, this reminds me of the time the Demogorgon met Medusa in the 1923 Miss Loathsome competition.
Keep trying, muttered Tweed. We've still got a few minutes. Next, have you any ideas?
For once, I didn't. With loathsome creatures from the id outside, a fictional person pretending to be real inside, and me in the middle wondering quite what I was doing here in the first place, creative thought wasn't exactly high on my agenda. I mumbled an apology and shook my head. There was a crunching sound as the questing beast made its way down the corridor amidst screams of terror and sporadic rifle fire.
Raffles! Yelled Tweed. How long?
2 minutes, old chum,
replied the safecracker without pausing or looking up. He had finished drilling the hole, made a small cup out of clay and stuck it against the side of the safe and was now pouring in what looked like liquid nitrogen. The battle outside seemed to increase in ferocity. There were shouts, concussions from grenades, screams, and the rattle of automatic weaponry until, After an almighty crash that shook the ceiling lights and toppled books from their shelves, all was quiet. We looked at one another. Then a gentle tap rang out, like the tip of a spear struck against the other side of the steel door. There was a pause, then another.
"Thank goodness," said Tweed in relief. "King Pellinore must have arrived and seen it off. Next, open the door."
But I didn't. Suspicious of loathsome beasts from the deepest recesses of the human imagination, I stayed my hand. It was as well that I did. The next blow was harder. The blow following that was harder still. The vault door shook.
"Blast!" exclaimed Tweed. "Why is there never a Pellinore around when you need one? Raffles, we don't have much time." "Just a few minutes more," replied Raffles quietly, tapping the safe door with a hammer while Bunny pulled on the brass handle.
Tweed looked at me as the library door buckled under another heavy blow. A split opened up in the steel, and the locking wheel sheared off and dropped to the ground. It wasn't a question of if the Glatticent got in. It was a question of when.
"Okay," said Tweed reluctantly, grabbing my elbow in anticipation of a jump. "That's it. Raffles, Bunny, out of here."
"Just a few moments longer," replied the safecracker with his usual calm. Raffles was used to fine deadlines and didn't like to give up on the safe, no matter what the possible consequences. The steel door buckled once more and the rent in the steel grew wider as the questing beast charged it with a deafening crash. Books fell off the shelves in a cloud of dust and a foul odour began to fill the air. Then, as the questing beast readied itself for another blow, I had the one thing that had eluded me for the past half hour, an idea. I pulled Tweed close to me and whispered in his ear.
"No," he said. "What if..."
I explained again, he smiled, and I began. "So one of you is fictional," I announced, looking at them both.
"And we have to find out who it is," remarked Tweed,
levelling his pistol in their direction.
"Might it be Yorick Kane?"
I added, staring at Kane, who glared back at me, wondering what we were up to.
"Failed right-wing politician,
with a cheery enthusiasm for war,
and putting a lid on civil liberties."
Tweed and I bantered lines back and forth for as long as we dared, faster and faster, the blows from the beast outside matching the blows from Raffles' hammer within.
"Or perhaps it's Volskamper,
Lord of the Old Realm, who wants to try and get back into power with the help of his friends at the Whig Party. But the important thing is, in all this dialogue that has pitched back and forward between the two of us, a fictional person
might have lost track of which one of us is talking.
And do you know, in all the excitement, I kind of forgot myself."
There was another crash against the door. A splinter of steel flew off and zipped past my ear. The doors were almost breached. With the next blow, the abomination would be upon us.
"So you're going to have to ask yourselves one simple question. Which one of us is speaking now?"
"You are,"
yelled Volskamper, pointing correctly at me. Kane, revealing his fictional roots by his inability to follow undedicated dialogue, pointed his finger at Tweed. He corrected himself quickly, but it was too late for the politician, and he knew it. He scowled at the two of us, trembling with rage. His charming manner seemed to desert him as we sprang the trap. Suaveness gave way to snarling, smooth politeness to clumsy threats.
"Now listen," growled Kane, trying to regain control of the situation. "You two are in way over your heads. Try to arrest me and I can make things very difficult for you. One footnotical phone from me and the pair of you will spend the next eternity on Gramocyte watch outside the OED.
But Tweed was made of stern stuff too.
"I've closed loopholes in Dracula and Biggles Flies East," he replied evenly. "I don't frighten easily. Call off the Glatticent and put your hands on your head. Leave Cardenio here with me, if only until tomorrow," added Kane, changing tack abruptly and forcing a smile. "In return, I can give you anything you want. Power, cash, an earldom, Cornwall, character exchange into Hemingway, you name it, Kane will provide."
"You have nothing of any value to bargain with, Mr. Kane," Tweed told him, his hand tightening on his pistol, "for the last time." But Kane had no intention of being taken, alive or otherwise. He cursed us both to a painful excursion in the 12th circle of hell and melted from view as Tweed fired. The slug buried itself harmlessly in a complete set of bound punch magazines. At the same time, the steel doors burst open. But instead of a pestilential hell beast conjured from the depths of mankind's most degenerate thoughts, only an icy rush of air entered, bringing with it the lingering smell of death. The questing beast had vanished as quickly as its master, back to the oral tradition and any books unfortunate enough to feature it.
"Cat!" yelled Tweed as he reholstered his gun. "We've got a page runner! I need a bookhound ASAP!"
"Coming up!"
Volskamper sat down on a handy chair and looked bewildered.
"You mean..." he stammered incredulously. "Look here! Cain was..."
"Entirely fictional, yes," I replied, laying a hand on his shoulder.
"You mean Cardenio didn't belong to my grandfather's library after all?"
he asked, his confusion giving way to sadness. "I'm sorry, Volskamper," I told him. "Cain stole the manuscript. He used your library as a front."
"And if I were you," added Tweed, in a less kindly aside, "I should just go upstairs and pretend you slept all through this. You never saw us, never heard us. You know nothing of what happened here."
"Bingo!" cried Raffles as the handle on the safe turned, shattering the frozen lock inside and creaking open. Raffles handed me the manuscript before he and Bunny vanished back to their own book, with only the thanks of jurisfiction to show for the night's efforts. A valuable commodity on their side of the law. I passed Cardenio to Tweed. He rested a reverential hand on the play and smiled a rare smile.
"An undedicated dialogue trap. Next, quick thinking. Who knows, we might make a jurisfiction agent of you yet."
"Well, thank—"
"Cat!" bellowed Tweed again. "Where's that blasted bookhound?"
"Any second now, Tweedy."
A large and sad-looking bloodhound appeared from nowhere, looked at us both lugubriously, made a sort of hopeless doggy sigh, and then started to sniff the book scattered on the floor in a professional manner. Tweed snapped a lead on the dog's collar.
"If I were the sort of person to apologize," he conceded, straining at the leash of the bookhound, who had locked onto the scent of one of Cain's expletives, "I would. Join me in the hunt for Cain?"
It was tempting, but I remembered Dad's prediction, and there was Landon to think of. "I have to save the world tomorrow," I announced, surprising myself by just how matter-of-fact I sounded. Tweed, on the other hand, didn't seem in the least surprised.
"Oh," he said. "Well, another time then. On, sir. Seek. Away."
The bookhound gave an excited bark and leaped forward. Tweed hung grimly to the leash and they both disappeared into fine mist and the smell of hot paper.
"I suppose,"
said Lord Volskamper, interrupting the silence in a glum voice,
"that this means I won't be in Cain's government after all."
"Politics is overrated," I told him.
"Perhaps you're right," he agreed,
getting up.
"Well, good night, Miss Next. I didn't see anything. Didn't hear anything. Is that right?"
"Nothing at all." Volskamper sighed and looked at the shattered remains of the interior of his house. He picked his way to the twisted steel door and turned to face me.
"Always was a heavy sleeper. Look here. Pop around for tea and scones one day, why don't you?"
"Thank you, sir. I shall. Good night." Volskamper gave me a desultory wave and was soon out of sight. I smiled to myself at the revelation of Cain's fictional identity. I reckon that not being a real person had to present a pretty good obstacle to being Prime Minister, but I couldn't help wondering just how much power he did wield within the world of fiction, and whether I had heard the last of him. After all, the Whig Party was still in existence, with or without their leader. Still, Tweed was a professional, and I had other things to deal with. I looked down the corridor past the twisted doors. The front of Vole Towers was virtually destroyed. The ceiling had collapsed and rubble lay strewn around where the Glatticent had fought the very finest of SO-14. I picked my way through the twisted door and down the corridor, where deep gouges had been scraped in the floor and walls by the leaden hide of the beast. The remaining Spec Ops 14 operatives had all pulled back to regroup, and I slipped out in the confusion. 9 good men fell to the questing beast that night. The officers would all be awarded the Spec Ops star for conspicuous bravery in the face of other. As I walked along the gravel drive away from what remained of Vol Towers, I could see a white charger galloping towards me, the warrior on its back holding a sharpened lance, while behind him a dog barked excitedly. I waved King Pellinor to a halt. "Ah," he said, raising his visor and peering down at me. "The next girl! Seen the questing beast, what?" "I'm afraid you've missed it," I explained. "Sorry." "Damn shame," announced Pellinor sadly, parking the lance in his stirrup. "Damn shame indeed, eh? I'll find it, you know. It is the lot of the Pellinors to go a-mollicking for the beastly beast. Come, sir, away." He spurred his steed and galloped off across the parkland of Vol Towers, the horse's hooves throwing great divots of grass high in the air, the large white dog running behind them, barking furiously. I returned to my apartment after giving an anonymous tip-off to the mole, suggesting that they confirm the ongoing existence of Cardenio. The fact that I still had the apartment verified once and for all that Landon hadn't been returned. I had been a fool to think that Goliath would honor their part of the deal. I sat in the dark for a while, but even fools need rest, so I went to sleep under the bed as a precaution, which was just as well. At 3 a.m, Goliath turned up, had a good look around and then left. I stayed hidden as a further precaution and was glad of this also, because Spec Ops turned up at 4 a.m. and did exactly the same. Confident now of no further interruptions, I crawled out from my hiding place and climbed into bed, sleeping heavily until 10 the next morning.